It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here. He's upset. He's annoyed. He's very dismayed by this proposal to somehow glom STS, secure transport, onto SMTP, the email server. No, he says. We'll find out why. We'll also talk about the latest tech news, including that 60 Minutes report last night on cell phone hacking. It's all coming up next on Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 556, recorded Tuesday, April 19th, 2016. SMTP STS. Security Now is brought to you by Audible.com. To download a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcasts.com/securitynow. And by Thinkst Canary. Detect attackers or malicious insiders on your network with honeypots that can be deployed in minutes. For 10% off and a 60-day money-back guarantee, go to canary.tools/twit and enter the code TWIT in the How Did You Hear About Us box. It's time for Security Now, the show where we protect you and your loved ones. What are you laughing at,
you're
Steve
rocking
Gibson?
You're rocking the baby?
I'm rocking a baby, showing how we protect
babies. You know what that
babies.
Reminds me of? That reminds me of if anybody, we've talked about The Good Wife a couple times.
Love that show.
But, oh, Leo, last Sunday, oh, it was just, it was so, I don't know if they like change writers or if the writers know they only have three more to go. And so they're just giving it, they're going out with a blast. But it was so full of little extra wonder. It was just spectacular. And the one guy, you know, holding the dog, he just walks around with this little dog with his arm, with his paws up in the air.
Oh, how funny.
And it's just, oh, gosh. So are you behind in
watching
it? Oh, I'm
years
it?
Behind. I'm only on season four, I think. So
it doesn't disappoint. Yeah. It continues to be good. And this is the last season. They have three episodes left or remaining and of this final season. But, oh, boy, is it wonderful. So I'm not sure what you were rocking, but, you know, reminded me.
Wasn't a dog. But I did not yet tell you that voice you hear is Steve Gibson. He is from GRC.com. He's our security guru. He's been doing this show for 10-plus years, 11 almost, and knows everything there is to know. We just actually, you probably have almost 11 because we just celebrated our 11th anniversary of Twit.
I think we're a few months away. Yeah. Boy, that 11th year went fast.
I know. We just did the 10th. I know. So you, let's see. So I started Twit in April. First show was April 17th, 2006. And I was still going up to Canada. And I think I was in Canada. I said, Steve, you and I should do a show.
It was between we would shoot, what was it, like four episodes of Call for Help.
It's horrible.
And it was between those episodes. I would come up and sit down with you and do things on a whiteboard because that was, you know, it was a TV show. And so we could count on visuals. And so I'd set up a whiteboard normally in between. And so you said to me, because you basically worked for 1 week out of the month, except for the weekends when you were doing the tech guide. So you had all this spare time. Meanwhile, podcasting was happening. And so you said to me, what would you think about doing a weekly podcast on like internet security? And I said, a what cast?
Really? And you didn't know what I was talking about?
And you said, you don't know about podcasting? I said, no, nobody does.
Nobody did. It was August 2005.
I'll never forget. I was watching MSNBC and Chris Matthews found out he had one and he was reading the teleprompter and he said, and also check for our what? our podcast? And then he like looks off the camera. What's a podcast? What's a pod?
Oh, I got to find that. I wonder if we
have something called a podcast.
I would love to find that somewhere. That's funny.
Anyway, and it's turned out to be the best thing that ever happened.
So, I love it. I mean, it is one of our absolute top podcasts. We have we've started our own ratings system because we haven't been able to find a reliable one. And so we're getting now finally consistent, reliable numbers. And as I see these numbers come in, it's just really mind-boggling how many people listen. It's something, I can't remember what it is, but it's something like 80,000 a week listen every single week to this show. And that's an amazing number. So, well done.
Well, thank you for suggesting it and for creating the forum and setting it up and the links and the bandwidth and everything else that you do. I'm happy to bring
80,000 people a week who are protected a little bit from the perils of the internet.
Well, and we have some more of that this week.
Oh, really?
On
what
Sunday, on Sunday, before the crazy fourth to the last episode of The Good Wife, 60 Minutes aired a one of their three pieces that they do every Sunday. The last one of the three was about cell phone hacking, and it generated a flurry of information. Now we've got the Senate worried because you know, basically they shined a bright light on something which we had already talked about back when it was news, which was the summer of 2014, the Chaos Computer Convention had an expose on this. And we talked about the baseband processor in cell phones, which gets very little attention. And back then, we talked about how, you know, this is something no one's looking at, and it's a big security problem. So we have to talk about that, sort of to follow up on what 60 Minutes talked about, and to give it a little additional fluffing up and context.
Well, and what's interesting is that we talked about it a couple of years ago. It's not improved, and it probably will never be improved. Those things just don't
actually
get updated.
As I was thinking about this and looking at all of the attention it got,
I thought it will.
The NSA, if they were dead, they would be turning over in their grave.
Please don't tell people about this.
They're not dead, and they are not happy.
No.
Because this is not something, I mean, it is so potent that they're like, oh, no. And the good news is nothing will happen.
It's hard to do, right? It's hard to fix.
It is. In fact, it's funny because the subtitle of this week's episode about a different technology is Horrible Internet Kludges Never Die. And similarly, you know, horrible, really old telco kludges never die. I mean, you can't change the way this stuff that is so deeply burned in to the infrastructure is built. And what 60 Minutes was talking about, and we'll be coming back to this when we're actually supposed to be talking about it, is a signaling system which glues individual providers together. And it's a deep, rich API that presumed nobody had access to the network. Well, once upon a time, nobody did. Then they said, oh, look, internet, and put everything on the internet. So everybody has access to the network. But nothing else changed. Anyway, we'll get there in a second. I wanted to talk about a recently released RFC, sort of perversely called Request for Comments. The only comment I had was a typo where they got the direction of something backwards. And I thought, am I going to bother telling them? And I thought, no, a whole bunch of other people will tell them. Anyway, this is about something which is definitely right in our wheelhouse, and that's the acronym or the abbreviation is SMTP STS. STS, of course, stands for Strict Transport Security, or sometimes Strict Transport Secrecy. I guess I like secrecy. I'm not sure which I like better, because it is really about encryption, so that's secrecy. Security requires has a bigger set of requirements. But of course, we've talked about HTTP STS, that is enforcing HTTPS essentially on the HTTP protocol. And this, unfortunately, tries to bring the same thing to email transport, that is SMTP, which is Simple Mail Transport Protocol. The bad news is what we really want is a good solution, which DNS security could provide, and so much more. But it's sort of not happening because there's a lot that has to happen in order for us to have any DNS security. Every piece of the system has to be in place, or we have none. So
moving in the direction, at least.
The root servers finally got signed, and that was a big deal. But it's the deployment has to happen, and unfortunately, DNSSEC is an all or nothing, and so it's like, okay, when? So in the meantime, this is an interim horrific kludge meant to kind of improve the security. And the problem is, in order to do it, it is just a god-awful mess. And as I'm reading through this, I'm thinking, oh, my Lord. I'll explain all of this at the end after we cover all of the news. And it's the kind of thing where I just hope this doesn't happen, because the subtitle is Horrible Internet Kludges Never Die. And if this ever does actually happen, then it'll always kind of be around, even when we don't actually need it any longer. Some people will keep using it, and it's to be like, and it's just awful. So anyway, so we'll have a lot of fun today. We'll talk about that 60 Minutes expose. I wanted to call this Black and Blueberry.
I know why. I know why.
Yes, because it turns out that it looks like the Canadian law enforcement had the master key for BlackBerry for the last 6 years, and then tried to suppress the court documents that disclosed that fact because they wanted to keep it a secret. Then, of course, I also wanted to call this quicksand for QuickTime, because QuickTime is in trouble. And we'll talk about some of the details that you didn't cover in MacBreak Weekly, because that's what we do here, like the nature of the two heap buffer overflows in QuickTime that require all Windows users to pull it. What wasn't found in the decrypted San Bernardino phone, a little conversation about Threema relative to WhatsApp and Signal, because the Threema guys weren't happy with all of the great press that WhatsApp got as Signal protocol was finally incorporated into it. And so they produced a big marketing checklist that has all green happy checks for them and all red unhappy X's for WhatsApp.
Oh,
and it's like, okay, you know, so like some of them are like, okay, we have less lint in our navel than they do.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, but that just doesn't have any real bearing on
big,
you know,
problem with
security.
Threema is it's not open source. That's kind of a significant problem, I think. Nor is
correct.
WhatsApp, for that matter.
Correct. But like Signal, for example, is
open source.
It is, except that, you know, it requires you like give it access to your contacts, and if you don't, it doesn't work. And it's like, wait a minute, what if I don't want to? So anyway, some fun conversation about that, and then we'll talk about, we have a little bit of errata and news of a very well regarded mini series starting tonight on, I think it's AMC. I've got it in my notes. That when I tweeted the news a few days ago, it first was released in the UK, and everyone over there said, "Oh my God, we've seen it! It's unbelievably good." And I've never seen 100% in Rotten Tomatoes, or I think it's like a 8.6 or something on IMDb. I mean, the highest scores I've seen. So, lots of stuff for today's podcast. And I forgot to ask you how many sponsors we have.
Two. We're going to do one now, and then we'll do one later. And by the way, I apologize for grossly underestimating your audience. Patrick Delahanty, who runs the code that does the audience measurement. And by the way, very sophisticated stuff we're doing, I'm really proud to say. 168,000 downloads of last week's episode so far. So far, which means you'll probably cross 200,000 by the time we're done. And that's uniques. We measure uniques. So
that has been some growth over the years.
Well, and partly it's because the measurement systems we were using had some serious flaws, which you did not uncover till more recently. And so we've had to roll our own. And now that I understand the code underlying and how it's working, I have some real confidence in these numbers. So there is a jump, but it's mostly, I think, because we switched providers.
Now counting correctly.
Well, what we're doing, at some point we should go through this.
Cause I'm still bouncing everything through PodTrack. Should I be
doing
fine. That?
Well, okay. No. In fact, I'll have Patrick email you. It still goes through PodTrack, but what we do is we have a redirect. We have a download link that's a twit.something. And then that does a double redirect. So it goes through our redirector and then PodTrack's redirector. Redirecting is, I know, it's not ideal. It won't be, that won't be for much longer. But redirecting is the only way to really effectively count. You would think you could look at server logs and stuff, but there are there's a lot of noise in a server log. For instance, podcast apps often open five streams at the same time, and you don't want to count that as five people. Yep. That's just one person.
I do the same thing on all of my download counts.
Yeah, you got to dedupe that.
I only count the retrieval of the first byte of the file.
Right. But at the same time, everybody who downloads from Microsoft comes in as the same IP address. So you don't want to count 1,000 people as one person either. So there's some black magic, and we've refined it over time. But to the point now where I feel very confident. And one of the tests is it's highly consistent. And shows like yours shouldn't show a lot of volatility. That was a warning sign when there was all this volatility. Every week was, 50% different.
And that's crazy. Yeah,
because especially shows like yours, which doesn't have different hosts, doesn't have different content, and most people I think subscribe to, you wouldn't expect big fluctuation. And so that was a red flag, and now that we've got our own system in place, it's very consistent as we would expect.
Nice.
So, a little behind the scenes stuff. 168,000, nice. That makes you bigger than the screensavers on Tech TV. That's what gets me when you get the actual. As one reviewer once said about Tech TV, they have the audience of a large high school. Our show today brought to you by Audible.com. We love Audible. We know you will love Audible because, after all, you're loved to listen, right? Wouldn't you love to listen to great literature on your commute, on the treadmill, walking the dog, doing the dishes? Well, You can. Audible.com. In fact, I'm going to set you up with a pretty good deal here. Your first book is free because I think we all understand that people who have never, done audiobooks might have some trepidation. Can you listen to the book and understand it? Do you have to rewind a lot? What is it like? Let me tell you from my own experience. I've been an Audible listener since 2000. The year 2000 for 16 years. I think I get more of the book. I really live the book, that's for sure. Sometimes I'll see the movie, or I won't see the movie, and somebody says, "Did you see the movie?" And I'll say, "Yeah, I saw the movie," and then realize, "Oh, no, I listened to the book, but it was like a movie." And I got all the details with you. Couldn't put it in a two-hour movie. Audiblepodcast.com/securitynow. You'll be signing up for the gold account. Your first one is free. You got 30 days. You'll also get the Daily Digest of the Wall Street Journal. Or the New York Times. You can cancel any time in the first 30 days and pay nothing. So, but that book is going to be yours to keep. So you're really getting a free book. This is the new Night's... No, not the Night's Dawn. Sorry. Let's look at Peter F. Hamilton because you just gave a rave review for the new Abyss Beyond Dreams.
Yep.
And I've been listening to this, and you are right. It is awesome. And what's great is if it stands alone... But if you've been reading, if you read other of his books, it's very much as a continuation of those. So the Ra'el are in it. The Void is in it. In fact, it starts in the Void, which is fun. So far, Al Capone's not in it, which, frankly, I'm glad about.
Oh, goodness, yes. That was a strange ending to the reality dysfunction stuff. It's like, I liked like three quarters of it, but the... Yeah. The old gangsters coming back from the dead. It's
that
like,
was weird.
Peter.
Yeah.
No.
But this is none of that. This is new. The new series, Peter F. Hamilton, who is one of our favorite sci-fi writers. It's called The Chronicle of the Fallers. This is book one. Books two and three are coming soon, Steve assures me. Because I hate it that I have to get to the end of the book and I go, oh, I got the next one. Where's the next one? So if you don't want to do that, good news. There's lots of other Peter F. Hamilton there, including the one we recommend as your starting point with the greatest science fiction writer writing today, I think, which is Falling Dragon. He's got a lot of – I just read the Great North Road, which is one of his murder mysteries, the Greg Mandel stories. That is really, really good. And they have it in German, too, apparently. That's nice. Audible is kind of a wonderful place. Audible, if you like fiction, if you like science fiction, they've got everything. They've even gone back and started re-recording old science fiction in their Audible Frontiers series, which is fantastic for people who haven't listened to the Philip K. Dick stories or the Heinlein stories, and they want to kind of get back to the original, you know, golden age of science fiction. You can rediscover all of this stuff. Dune, all of them. So here's the deal. Audiblepodcast.com/securitynow. Your first one's free. Hardest part is choosing one book, but don't worry. You'll get another one next month and the month after and the month after if you decide to continue. I think you will. Audiblepodcast.com/securitynow. It is a wonderful, wonderful bookstore. All right, continuing on, Steve.
So, okay, there's two different problems with cell stuff. One we talked about when we were addressing this whole subject years ago, and that's that there is another processor that we never talk about in every cell phone, which for historical reasons is called the baseband processor. Apple has been making noises about doing their own for some time. But at this point, they're still purchasing them from Qualcomm at a cost of about $33 a piece, which makes it an expensive component of all Apple smartphones. And thus, you know, they look at that and think, you know, we don't really need to be buying this from a third party. Yet there is a lot of technology there. It is an ARM-based system with firmware, and it's rumored that there's bugs there. And the problem is that no one looks there. We're all, you know, when we're talking about iOS security white papers and breaking into the phones and the FBI decrypting this and fingerprints and, you know, all of that is completely separate from this baseband processor that's just sitting there quietly, not getting anyone's attention. And probably the people who know where the flaws are quite happy with that state of affairs. They don't want us looking there. And it's difficult to look there because there isn't the same kind of – we don't have a relationship with it the way we have with the A7X and the A8 and the secure enclave and all. You know, it's not very exciting. It just sort of – you know, it is the thing that hooks us to the rest of the world when we have a cellular connection as opposed to a Wi-Fi connection. It's not sexy, but it's crucially important that it be secure. And it's probably not, but we don't know because we don't look at it very often. And, you know, if history teaches us anything, it's, you know, what you don't look at is a problem because it's probably got problems that are, you know, unobserved and that there are people who know what they are. Now, completely separate from that is a known problem, a known huge problem. And that is the protocol which glues all of these baseband cell phones together. And it's known as Signaling System 7, SS7. And it is old. which is one of the first problems. Anytime, you know, it's like SSL version 1.0. Actually, it's the same era. It's from the 1980s. And so back a long time ago, when the mobile phone system was just kind of beginning to happen, this system was put together, and the presumption was that there would be hard wires that were linking, you know, like leased lines that were linking individual cell phone carriers to each other in a private electrical network, not packet switching, but leased line. And the idea being that the presumption was, well, these are our wires. Nobody will have access to them. So the protocols that they developed had no concept of security. That just wasn't necessary. If you have a leased line connecting Sprint to AT&T and they hook up to each end, you know, it's like, well, you know, and they have a subscriber transit agreement, very much like top tier peering agreements we have on the internet. Then, you know, it's like, okay, we're going to connect to each other, and so we need some protocol for like handing a subscriber off. Like, what if two mobile phone customers want to, on different networks, want to talk to each other? Well, we need some way to handle that, and we need to have billing information. And you know, what if they want to do a conference call? We have to have a conferencing protocol. And what if the subscriber has two phones, and we need to deal with SIMs and all this? So all of this kind of got developed quietly by the carriers to fulfill their own needs. And there are two key mobile protocols called MAP and CAMEL, M-A-P and C-A-M-E-L. And because of the time frame when this happened, they have no authentication. There is no concept of authentication.
Can you put a layer on top of it?
In this entire system. Well, you could, but then everyone would have to support it, or it wouldn't work. And so today, at this moment, the entire international mobile phone system is essentially open. And what 60 Minutes demonstrated was something that was demonstrated in the summer of 2014 in the Chaos Computer Club. And in the show notes, for anyone who wants to dig deeper, I mean, it are links to videos that are 2 years old, showing and what the 60 Minutes show demonstrated, which was riveting, was, yeah, there's one of them. And there's also somewhere, maybe it's toward the bottom of that page, is a 140 slide deck of 140 slide deck of slides. There it is, that red one, where that went along with the presentation, showing like the nature of the complexity of the system. All of this has been now reverse engineered. That is, the messaging protocols and how they work. This 140 slides shows the evolution into a network of protocols linking sort of these sprawling pieces of the system and all the points of attack which hackers now have access to. And what 60 Minutes demonstrated was all you have to have is anyone's cellular phone number. And that's all you have to have to set this up for the demonstration on the show last Sunday. They got a brand new iPhone, and might have been purchased, and gave it to I don't remember now if he was a senator or someone in the House of Representatives, but they said, with your permission, we want to provide you with this phone, and we'll give you a call, and you need to know that this is part of the a piece we're doing on mobile phone hacking. So anything, and we'll be working with some German hackers, and these are the guys that worked this out 2 years ago and showed everybody. And we talked about it back then, but nothing happened. And so so you'll be subject to maybe if these guys can pull it off, eavesdropping. And so he agrees. And so the 60 Minutes person calls and they have a conversation. And that's all it took. With knowing his number, it is possible to essentially install what amounts to a man in the middle, such that his physical location is known, his SMS messages are captured, his voice conversations are in the clear, and basically everything he does with the phone at the cellular level. Now, not smartphone stuff, but conversations and text messaging, all available. And so later in the show, they played back non-sensitive conversations that he had with other people that were completely intercepted by this. I mean, and it's a very compelling piece. And I'm not going to spend any more time on it because there's really nothing more to be said, except just sort of as a heads up that the mobile phone system doesn't begin to be secure. And there's no question that law enforcement knows this and uses this without a moment's second thought. There are international commercial entities known to be selling SS7 hacking tools to governments and law enforcements throughout the world. So if anyone is having a conversation that isn't encrypted, for example, by Signal or WhatsApp or some additional encryption layer, and if you're not using iMessage or WhatsApp or Signal or Threema or, you know, some additional something other than just SMS text messages, then everything you're doing, the conversations you're having and the simple messaging system, SMS messages, completely available to anyone who has access to the system and knows the phone number you're using. And so basically, this is why the notion of a burner phone has been in movies and plots for a long time, and apparently is what people wanting to maintain anonymity do. Is they get burner phones and they use them for a short time and they toss them because the system that they're using is known not to be secure in any way, shape, or form.
So the only way to secure it is if no one knows your phone number.
Correct.
So a burner phone works only because the phone number is known only to your confederate, but it's presumably at some point government might figure that out, and that's that.
Correct.
Although stingrays would figure it out.
Anything that's able to like to create a fake tower, then it's gonna know who you are and where you are, and be able to decrypt your conversations too. So basically, you know, it's just an insecure network. Now, exactly as you were saying at the beginning, Leo, all of the things we're doing, layering our own end-to-end crypto on top, that's secure. But, you know, most people aren't doing that. You know, I'm not having, when I have a conversation, I'm not bothering to like move the conversation over to a secure channel.
But as an example, if you used WhatsApp, which has phone calling, and many messaging apps do, that's encrypted over on top of, you know, the broken SS7. So that would be secure, right?
Or not? Well, except the metadata would not.
They know who you're calling.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So there, and there is no way to protect that. I mean, that is, you know, as has been said, the metadata.
Wait a minute. What if the signaling, though, is not done through the cell network, was done through the data network using an encrypted channel?
Well, yes. And in fact, that's one of the things you can do is turn off the, you know, go into.
Don't use your cell phone calling capability.
Correct. Shut down the cellular radio and use Wi-Fi.
LTE concerned. Data, couldn't you? Because it's data. It's not phone number data, so you can still.
Good question. I don't know.
I mean, they could. Have to use Tor or something like that, because they'd know the endpoints of the LTE conversation.
Yeah, my takeaway is, we all want to have privacy, yet no one seems very willing to give up much for it. And, you know, all of the tests that we've read have shown like how little, you know, like, here's a candy bar. Can I have your password? Ooh, chocolate, you know, and like, people don't value that so much. I think there's a subset of people who really do care. And I respect that. I think those people should have the tools at their disposal for real privacy.
But we're not talking government intrusion alone. For instance, somebody could use this to get your second factor authentication from your bank, right? So if they knew your phone number, and I mean, they could get they'd have to know your bank password first. But if they got your password, then all they need is your phone number, and they can get that authentication code, for instance.
Yes,
right?
I forgot to mention when I was talking about Hover last week. One of the things I liked about them is that they do offer two-factor authentication, and for access to my registrar, that's somewhere I'm not messing around with security.
Yeah.
My domains are crucial to me. They offer two forms, and I did want to reiterate and I forgot to last week. I chose the Google style time-based authentication specifically because there is no question it is superior, vastly, dramatically superior security. I do not want a 6-digit SMS text message coming to me when I log into my Hover account. I much prefer recording I got it from them, the big key that drives the crypto in the time-based authenticator, and then have that in my phone, so that it's generating a sequence of 6-digit keys with a 30-second life, and when I want to log in, I provide that without prompting, except for the field that I have to fill in to my Hover account. So I just did want to note that you know, exactly as you said, Leo, receiving text messages. This is another perfect example of why that's not really good. I mean, it's better than nothing, but it's not second factor authentication that's nearly as secure as establishing a time changing, you know, a time based additional factor where after it has been established, no communication of it needs to pass back and forth.
Yeah, well, this is a good reason to
Yeah.
So if you have a choice between an authenticator app, they always say Google-based authentication, but it's really not Google. It's not. It's a standard. But if you have a choice between authenticator-based authentication, use that software-based authentication versus text-based.
Right.
Text is convenient, right. And you may not have the choice. My bank doesn't give me the choice, but they should.
Right. And I did appreciate that Hover
does.
Did.
Yeah.
Yep. So, okay. I have to set this up so that the statement from BlackBerry's CEO, so that we'll have the context for it, because it's just the most mealy-mouth, non-confirmation you could imaginable. So this begins with Vice, that Vice.com, who uncovered from court documents, and not just a few, it's thousands of pages of court documents that this was buried in. And so from Vice's coverage, they wrote, "The revelations are contained in a stack of court documents that were made public after members of a Montreal crime syndicate pleaded guilty to their role in a 2011 gangland murder. The documents shed light on the extent to which the smartphone manufacturer," and they're referring to BlackBerry because the headline was "Canadian police obtained BlackBerry's global decryption key." And when we learn some horrifying things by implication also about the much vaunted BlackBerry encryption, which doesn't impress me at all, because the fact that this was possible tells us that, you know, this BlackBerry encryption was crap. Like, for all these years, we thought, oh, it's the best encryption there is. And, it was completely secret. And now we find out, well, it was a secret that should have been better kept because it's awful. Vice says the documents shed light on the extent to which the smartphone manufacturer, as well as the telecommunications giant Rogers, cooperated with investigators. According to technical reports by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police that were filed in court, law enforcement intercepted and decrypted roughly 1 million pin-to-pin BlackBerry messages, and we'll explain what pin-to-pin means in a second, messages in connection with the probe. The report doesn't disclose exactly where the key, effectively a piece of code that could break the encryption on virtually any BlackBerry message sent from one Vice to another, came from. But as one police officer put it, it was a key that could unlock millions of doors. Government lawyers spent almost 2 years fighting in a Montreal courtroom to keep this information out of the public record. And while neither the RCMP nor BlackBerry confirmed that the cell phone manufacturer handed over the global decryption key, and both fought against a judge's order to release more information about their working relationship, the Crown prosecutors admitted that the Federal Police Service had access to the key. And if the global key is still sitting on a server in the RCMP's headquarters, the potential consequences could be significant, although it wouldn't offer police a backdoor into most of its government and business clients. And that's a key.
They say that government's the most important because, by the way, every member of Congress in the United States uses BlackBerry. And you can bet the RCMP has given those keys to the U.S. law enforcement, right? And you don't want Congress critters to start saying, what do you mean, somebody's listening in on my phone?
Uh-huh. They say, although it wouldn't offer police a back door into most of its government and business clients who make up BlackBerry's core constituency, it would mean that police enjoyed years of access. And we're talking from 2010. So at this point, 6 years. Years of access to Canadians' personal cell phones without the public being any the wiser. In a technical report attempting to underscore the significance of this technology and filed with the Superior Court of Quebec, the RCMP stated that it had obtained, quote, the key that would unlock the doors of all the houses of the people who use the provider's services and that without their knowledge. Okay, so then this was also done along with Motherboard, who said BlackBerry, formerly RIM, encrypts all messages sent between consumer phones known as pin-to-pin or BBM messages using a single global encryption key, which is where, you know, we just put our face in our hands because it's like, what? What? That's loaded onto every handset during manufacturing.
Makes it a lot easier to just hand that out.
Oh, boy. With this one key, any and all messages sent between consumer BlackBerry phones can be decrypted and read. In contrast, business enterprise servers, that's, you know, the BES that we've talked about years past, the BES servers, business enterprise servers, allow corporations to use their own encryption key, which not even BlackBerry can access. According to more than 3,000 pages of court documents pertaining to the case that resulted from what's known as Project Clemenza, obtained by Vice Canada, the RCMP maintains a server in Ottawa that, quote, simulates a mobile device that receives a message intended for the rightful recipient. In other words, a man in the middle. In an affidavit, RCMP Sergeant Patrick Boismenu states that the server, quote, performs the decryption of the message using the appropriate decryption key. The RCMP calls this the, quote, BlackBerry Interception and Processing System. So, naturally, news of this required a response from BlackBerry. John Chen, who is the wunderkind, apparently, chairman and CEO.
No, he's not. He's the guy they brought in because the company was falling apart.
Right.
Yeah. So I don't know if he's a wunderkind or just...
Well, but in the past, I guess he was, you know, he was like responsible for major, you know, dazzling successes in previous things he did.
Oh, I doesn't see. Look, yes. Not, a, does, not yes. there, of course.
Right.
Yeah.
Doesn't look like that's happening here. So he did a blog posting titled Lawful Access, which is the first clue. Corporate citizenship, okay, second clue, and doing what's right, third clue. And he says, I just have one paragraph from a relatively short blog posting where he said essentially nothing. But so given some serious reading between the lines, which is what's necessary, he said, but he also slaps Apple. He says, when it comes to doing the right thing in difficult situations, BlackBerry's guiding principle has been to do what is right for the citizenry within legal and ethical boundaries. We have long been clear in our stance that tech companies, as good corporate citizens, should comply with reasonable, lawful access requests. Okay, now... Okay, he's continuing just to finish this paragraph. I have stated before that we are indeed in a dark place when companies put their reputations above the greater good. Oh, okay. So that tells you all you need to know. He's saying that, yes, we did not take the position Apple took of saying no. We complied with, as part of our corporate citizenship, with lawful access requests. Now, I would argue what they did was massively overly broad. There are some diagrams that I've seen that show the details of the man in the middle. And basically, they did hand over the master key that then allowed for unrestrained monitoring of the BlackBerry network. Completely, of basically any conversation, anyone's phone that they chose to. So I think that's pretty much the end of BlackBerry, at least the end of any notion that we were holding that they have some magic secret security that had been, unobserved, but we just assumed was fabulous. You know, if all phones have a single key such that knowing it allows you to decrypt everything the system is doing, then that's awful. I mean, it's essentially what everyone was saying that installing a back door would require. And we know that you can do a secure decryption on demand in an intelligent fashion. This is not that. This is the worst possible design.
Yeah.
So,
I mean,
wow.
I think BlackBerry always assumed, well, if you really cared about security, you'd run your own BlackBerry server, your own BES server. And in fact, that would be your own generated key. Certainly that's what government and business probably does. It's just it's kind of the you and me who would just buy a BlackBerry phone. And they always sold it as secure, but I never really believed them. So now we know.
Yeah.
They gave the keys. They were many countries demanded the key. I used to say keys. Now
they
say key.
They said no to somebody.
I think India or maybe China.
Yeah, I can't remember who now. Oh, Pakistan wanted it.
Okay.
And they said no. Sorry.
I think Pakistan wanted source code to the server.
Oh.
They didn't hand that over. But now we know a single key unlocks all phones that run through BlackBerry's own servers.
Wow. Yeah, and everybody knows.
Yeah, to tell the Canadians tell the states, the Americans tell the English, it doesn't take long.
Yep.
It's probably on a bulletin board somewhere.
So, QuickTime is officially no longer, Apple has stated, going to be updated on the Windows platform. And the problem is Trend Micro found a couple problems with QuickTime, the latest version from Apple, the last version from Apple that will ever be released. And said, "Hey Apple, we got some serious heap overflow problems that we found." And Apple said, "Yeah, well, we're not going to change them. We're not going to fix it. We're not going to do anything." So that released Trend from what they considered their responsible disclosure obligation, where they would have otherwise waited and let Apple have the time to fix the problem. Apple's never going to fix the problem. So Trend immediately went public and said, "We're putting the word out that everyone should follow Apple's guidance and uninstall QuickTime for Windows as soon as possible. This is for two reasons. First," they wrote, "Apple is deprecating QuickTime for Microsoft Windows. They will no longer be issuing security updates for the product on the Windows platform and recommend users uninstall it. And they say, note, this does not apply to QuickTime on Mac. Second, our zero-day initiative, this is Trend Micros, has just released two advisories detailing two new critical vulnerabilities affecting QuickTime for Windows. These advisories are being released in accordance with the zero-day initiative's disclosure policy for when a vendor does not issue a security patch for a disclosed vulnerability. And because Apple is no longer providing security updates for QuickTime on Windows, these vulnerabilities are never going to be patched. I did a little more digging and found that they said both of these are heap corruption, remote code execution vulnerabilities. In one case, an attacker is able to write data outside of an unallocated heap buffer. Yikes. The other vulnerability occurs in what's called the STCO atom, where by providing an invalid index, an attacker can write data outside of an allocated heap buffer. Both vulnerabilities would require a user to visit a malicious web page or open a malicious file to exploit them. And both vulnerabilities would execute code in the security context of the QuickTime player, which in most cases would be that of the logged on user. So this is not just the QuickTime plugin, but this is any document type that QuickTime has registered itself as the handler for in Windows. The most probable attack vector, I would think, would probably be spear phishing or maybe just more broad, you know, spray phishing, where, you know, it's the standard come on of, you know, here's the invoice for, you know, the something you didn't purchase email, and you go, what? I didn't purchase that. And you click on it, and it's an obscured URL that actually goes to some QuickTime document, which contains code that then executes on your machine. So it's a means for allowing a malicious document to run on your machine. Now, again, security context of the logged on user, this is less a problem on modern Windows than it used to be, because you have to elevate your privilege going through the user account control typically to do anything important. And on the other hand, a lot of users just click through that. So, you know, for naive users, this isn't going to protect them. So, boy, removing QuickTime for Windows would be a good thing to do. In fact, it would be nice if, I don't know if Microsoft would ever do this, but because, you know, Windows Update is really the only way to push anything out, as we well know, to everyone on Windows. It would be nice if they pushed out something that would alert you if you did have QuickTime installed and at least, you know, give you a heads up about getting it removed. To me, this feels like a big problem. Although, Leo, do you think QuickTime is, you know, where would it be installed? Would it be typically installed in like newer editions of Windows?
No, it's not installed by default. It's only installed if you install, well, a lot of people have it from installing iTunes. So iTunes no longer requires QuickTime, but in the past it has. And so if you installed iTunes on Windows, which of course everybody who used an iPod had to do, you would have gotten QuickTime with that install. Now, in fact, so many people had problems with iTunes that we often recommended you install QuickTime separately. So you install QuickTime and then install iTunes. And that fixed some problems people had in Windows. So those people may still have legacy. It's an old version of QuickTime. It's very old.
Did you need that for like codec support?
That's the other issue. I'm told that I think so. Or actually, no, that was the player in iTunes. I mean, iTunes did not work.
Oh, that's right. I remember seeing the little window come up.
It had
a nice sort of a brushed silver look.
Yeah, it's old, though. I mean, it's not not required by modern versions of iTunes. The other problem, though, and it's much more significant, is that in some programs, I think Adobe Premiere, their video editor is one of them.
I've seen stuff bring QuickTime along. It's like, what the heck is that doing?
You need it for Pro. If you want to do ProRes, which is Apple's format. That's, by the way, the format this show is recorded in. And our editors all have QuickTime installed on their computers because they use Adobe Premiere to edit the show.
What a mess.
So it's a problem. Yeah. I don't know. Russell's in Las Vegas for NAB, but when he gets back, I'll talk to him, and I guess we'll have to figure out what to do. So, don't know.
Thanks. Anyway, anybody who's listening to the podcast, if you don't know you need it, I guess just go into, programs and settings and, or programs and, I think that's what it's called, whatever it is.
Yeah, programs and settings. It changes all the time.
Yeah, it does. and see if you've got QuickTime. Probably says, what is it? You think it's under A for Apple QuickTime, or maybe Q for QuickTime for Windows?
Beats me. And by the way, it's programs and features in more modern versions
of
Windows.
That's right, programs and features.
Install the programs.
And just remove it. Hopefully you've pulled Flash out if you don't need it, and now it's time to pull QuickTime out. We're moving slowly forward, removing these things which are problems. But maybe Apple could do this. Well, I wonder if QuickTime checks itself for updates. Does it have an auto update feature?
Well,
because Apple could take responsibility and push out an update that removes it from the system. Although they don't want to pull it away from people who do need it.
Right.
It's a mess.
It's a mess.
Yeah. So CBS News had some exclusive reporting. They found someone who was willing to talk about what the FBI found, or rather didn't, on Farouk's unlocked phone. A law enforcement source told CBS News that so far nothing of real significance has been found on the San Bernardino terrorist's iPhone, which was unlocked by the FBI last month without the help of Apple. Pat Milton, who's the senior investigative reporter for CBS, reported that it was stressed to him by his source that the FBI continues to analyze the information on the cell phone seized in the investigation, which is just their way of saying, well, yeah, but we're not saying we're done yet, probably because they're not happy by saying after all of this noise, they didn't find anything. I did want to mention, as I said at the top of the show, that Threema put together a rebuttal page to all of the glowing conversation about the Signal protocol fully being integrated into WhatsApp. And I also wanted to take the time to make the point that it was Signal I was talking about last week, and that WhatsApp is a container for Signal. But for example, the fact that you have to give it your phone number, that's the way it identifies you, that's sort of annoying. I mean, it's an immediate loss of anonymity. Whereas, for example, Threema doesn't require that you give a phone number. Where possible, Threema is as anonymous as it can be because they allow payment, which is, I think, $3, or at least it is on iOS. But iOS, of course, you're not anonymous because if you have to buy something through iOS, you're known to Apple. But on the Android platform, where it is possible to be anonymous, you're able to purchase with Bitcoin. And they grumble that Threema grumbles. They have a clear economic model where you pay a little bit for support and the product. And then why you're getting the service from us. But basically, I mean, anyone who's done any competitive marketing has seen these charts where, it's all good news for the person preparing the chart and bad news for the others. Some of their points are good. One person made a raised a very good point via Twitter in the intervening week, and that is that WhatsApp, i.e. Signal in WhatsApp, doesn't give any residual indication when you've confirmed that you and the person you're communicating with have identical keys. That is, you did this on the show and showed it on the video, Leo, where the two opposite ends of a signal-based Threema dialogue, when your phone saw the other phone's QR code, it gave a big happy green check mark that then just sort of faded away. And so it was an easy way of doing the verification, but it didn't mark it somehow. And of course, Threema is all about authentication. It always has been, which of course is my own. You know, I keep reminding people that you have to have authentication or you really have no protection from a man in the middle. And so, you know, Threema has those three sort of, I think of them as the traffic signal lights, yellow, green, and red, for what level of authentication has been provided this connection. And it's, you know, every contact you have is branded with how sure you are, you know, how much have you authenticated their, you know, the other person's identity. So anyway, I wanted to separate explicitly our conversation of WhatsApp, that is an entity owned by Facebook, from their incorporation of the Signal protocol. And I was a little disappointed even to download Signal, which I took the time to do, and saw that it too needed access to my contacts list. And actually, Leo, it was you and Lisa showed up among my contacts.
As the only
people I could connect to.
That's a convenience, because otherwise, yes. How do you find people?
Yes.
So, but of course, it leaks information. And now we know if somebody knows your cell phone number, you're screwed. So that's probably not good information to leak.
Yeah. So, and again, everyone says they want security, but we all tend to take convenience over security. And so, and I think if anything that this podcast is teaching us all, it's that it is security in the ivory tower, you know, in the land of the cryptographers. That's the only place it is pure. The only place it is, it reaches its, like, its theoretical perfection. Because the moment the rubber hits the road, the moment it becomes time to deploy it, then the real world gets in the way. And so, you know, it is the idea of absolute security is an illusion, because there are so many other things that can go wrong in the actual implementation of it.
Yeah.
So I just think it's important to have that perspective, because it's the truth.
And I think Apple admits, in fact, I seem to remember, and I wish I can't find it. I think it was Tim Cook saying recently, "Will we carefully weigh security with the convenience of our customers?"
Right.
And their kind of admission.
iMessage is the perfect example. Yeah. iMessage manages the keys
right. For
the people you're encrypting to, which means, you know,
for your
They could be any for your convenience.
For your convenience.
That's right. Okay, two little bits of errata. One bit of errata. Never 10 did get bumped up. I gave it a 1,000th of a bump in the version number. 1.3 I talked about last week, where I added the ability to delete all of the files that might have been downloaded ahead of time and hidden, and also a series of command line switches that could be used by enterprise. Well, friend of the show, Evan Katz, found a bug in 1.3 because, and it's absolutely a bug, I wrote a new parser for it and failed to exclude the text before the command line arguments. I don't know what I was thinking. It was an oversight. And Evan had a network drive in the path programs and updates / and he put never 10 in there. And when he tried to then run it from that network share on a different machine, it appeared not to run. Well, it was running, but it saw the phrase update in programs and updates and treated that as a command line switch. Whoops. Anyway, 1.3.1 fixes that. And so, you know, it wasn't worth giving it a 0.4, just a bug, plain and simple. I overlooked it. And so thank you, Evan, for bringing it to my attention. And that's fixed now. And I did get reports from a bunch of people saying that they'd recovered. I saw one just this morning, 5 gig of hard drive space by running version 1.3 just once. So
it's a 3 gig download, but as you pointed out last week, it expands it after it downloads it, which can make it much, much larger. Jeez.
Yes.
Couldn't you wait to expand it till you needed it?
Yeah, wouldn't you think?
God.
So, unfortunately, I did tweet this for people who follow me, but it's on AMC, and it's titled The Night Manager. I think that's the title
movie.
Of the Yes.
Yeah.
Or a book. It's a miniseries, and it's starring Hugh Laurie.
Oh, I love Hugh Laurie, of course.
Yes. He of course was Dr. House in the series House. And I'll never forget seeing some of the behind the scenes stuff and listening to his accent for the first time. It's like, wow. He doesn't have an accent when he's Dr. House.
He's really good. But Fry and Laurie, Stephen Fry and Hugh Laurie, when they were at Cambridge, had a wonderful comedy duo. You've got to look up Fry and Laurie on YouTube. Hysterical.
Oh, good.
Yeah, they're Brits. But this is a great Jean Le Carré novel.
Yes, that's what it is.
I love Jean Le Carré. He's just wonderful.
So I picked up on it because one of the things I do, I've mentioned, I have TiVo sucking in Charlie Rose. And Charlie is, unfortunately, a lot of it is about politics lately. And, the U.S. election has just gotten to be so, so repetitious and annoying. So, but he interviewed, Charlie Rose interviewed Hugh Laurie and they discussed this. So this is not like some hotel night manager. Hugh Laurie plays an international arms dealer. And so IMDb rated it at 8.6 of 10. Rotten Tomatoes gave it 100%. Wow. I tweeted it. A whole bunch of our listeners in the UK were just jumping up and down raving. One person said that the first episode put him to sleep. It's like, well, okay, maybe he took the healthy sleep formula too early in the evening.
Well, Carré is very – it's not James Bond. Carré is – I mean, he's where The Spy Came In from the Cold. You might have seen that movie.
Right.
He is a – I think Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy was a wonderful miniseries based on his books. His character, Smiley, is a very – it's not swashbuckling. But I feel very accurate, very realistic.
Well, apparently this picks up after the first episode, so people should not be disappointed. The first one is a little bit of a stage setting episode, but then it kicks in. And what Hugh said was that what was different for him was that he was dying to produce this. Whereas with House, he would show up and they would give him a script and he would just do it. This has his heart and soul. He really was excited to do this. So it starts tonight. So I'm afraid that people who are not hearing the podcast until tomorrow will be behind, but I'm sure you'll be able to catch up or they'll, run them all together. They called it a mini series. So I meant to look to see if it's like in successive nights or is it just going to be in over the north, you know, like once a week. I don't know what the schedule is. But so the night manager on AMC in the U.S. and everybody in the U.K. already knows all this.
I'm logging into my TiVo right now to record it. By the way, that is a nice feature.
I love it. I use it all the time.
Love my TiVo. All right. Night manager.
And a little quick Zio update. There for all of the 2,500 plus listeners who got Zios, there is an effort underway to create replacement headbands. That's the one thing about it that has the potential to wear out because it uses three conductive silver bumps. Anyway, zeoband.com, zeoband.com. He's still sort of trying to gauge interest. And it's funny, too, because he sent out a mailing to those who had registered a while ago saying, this really started out kind of slowly, but interest suddenly ramped up for some reason.
I know why.
And I don't know what happened. It's like, and the world is also all out of Seraphos for some strange reason. If you're playing with your Zio, you might just go over to zeoband.com and let them know that you're interested. Maybe, I think I heard something about $15, so it seems reasonable for a replacement headband. And somebody working in the GRC news groups has almost finished an amazing new Zio app for Android that does all kinds of stuff. Much higher resolution. Instead of 5-minute intervals, you get 30-second intervals. You can do journaling. You can annotate them. You can export the database over to the Java-based Zio Viewer. Just, it's unbelievable. Unbelievable feature packed. It's not quite out of beta. We're all using it over in the grc.health news group. As soon as it hits 1.0, I just don't want to deluge him with additional testers because he's not really ready yet. So I'm not pointing people to it, though I've already created a bit.ly shortcut for when it's time. So I just want to let people know there will be an additional open source GitHub third party Zio app happening soon. And lastly, I got a nice note from a good day, Steve, from Canberra, Australia, Simon Byrne, who sent under the subject of Spinrite recovers SSDs, ? And then he says, has in all caps, you bet it does. He says, good day, Steve. I bought Spinrite years ago for no other reason than to support you and the Security Now podcasts. Thank you. Last Saturday, I fired up my MacBook Pro with a 1 terabyte Outer World Computing SSD installed. It got halfway and then shut down. Not good. I do video production and generate very large amounts of data. I do have a good local backup regime, but backing up over the web is impractical as I generate many gigabytes every day. However, I was working the day before off-site with no local backup, so I was faced with losing a full day's work, which equated to about 12 gigabytes. I took the SSD drive out of my Mac and put it into one of my PCs and fired up Spinrite on level 2. 9 hours later, Spinrite had finished reporting no errors recovered. I was disappointed that no errors were shown, so I was dubious as to whether it was going to work. I tentatively put the SSD back into my Mac and turned it on. And yes, in all caps, he says, it booted up perfectly. I immediately backed up all my data. So yes, Spinrite absolutely can recover data on an SSD drive. Thanks, Simon, for the report and confirmation of what we've been finding and the reason for a long future life of Spinrite.
Let's take a break, and then more. We'll talk about SMTP security or not.
And, oh, God.
How not to do it. Another fine episode of How Not to Do It. But first, let's talk about securing your network, how to do it. Of course, you can have lots of security on your network, but the question is, if you were compromised, how would you know that you've been compromised? I think Sony Pictures Entertainment wishes they were running a canary. I think the Office of Personnel Management and Target and the IRS wishes they were running a canary. From Thinkst, go to canary.tools/twit and you'll find out more. You sprinkle a few canaries on your system. Make them like honeypots. Make them desirable. Maybe one's a router, one's a Windows file share. Maybe one's passwords.txt. I don't know. Attackers, APT, and malicious insiders advertise their presence by interacting with your canary, and you get a single high-quality alert to let you know what has happened. It's easy to set up, under 4 minutes. Configuration is a snap. They will look exactly like a router, a switch, a NAS server, a Linux box, or a Windows server. Attackers will not know, cannot tell the difference. They don't look vulnerable on your network. They look valuable. You know, this is not an obvious honeypot. It just looks like something's good on it. Like I said, put passwords.txt on it and share that with a Windows SMB share. You can even roll a canary in Active Directory. It'll show up just like it's a normal device on your network. And the best part is when attackers do attack with Canary, you won't get hundreds of alerts, just one high-quality alert when it matters. It's not going to bug you. You won't even have to worry about your Canary. Just let it sit there waiting for intrusions. Thinkst, T-H-I-N-K-S-T, the company behind Canary, has been doing this for nearly two decades. They have trained the military, countless companies, governments, on both how to break into networks and how to protect networks. And all that experience has helped them build one of the most amazing... I can't wait. We're supposed to get one soon. Instead of a massive upfront cost, canaries are licensed annually. If your birds break during the year, Thinkst just replaces them. And their pricing makes it easy to try a few and scale up as you want. Smaller shops like ours, maybe a couple of canaries, banks, hundreds of them all over the network, so you know exactly what's going on. It's amazing. You got to have these. They're deployed all over the world, from Australia to Iceland. Yes, there's some in Canberra. Some of the biggest names in Silicon Valley run them, and they love them. You will, too. Canary.tools/twit. $7,500 a year. For that, you get five canaries, your own hosted console, upgrades, support, and maintenance for a full year. And right now, because you're listening to Security Now, if you visit canary.tools/twit and use twit in the offer code, actually, I guess it's a how did you hear about us box, you'll get 10% off your canaries forever. Forever. It'll save you $750 in the first year alone. We're sure you'll love your Thinkst Canary, but if you're not happy, you can always return it with their 2-month money back guarantee for a full refund. Canary.tools/twit. Enter the code TWIT in the How Did You Hear About Us box to get 10% off your canary. I love the name Canaries. I love the name Thinkst. Thinkst Canary from canary.tools/twit. We talked about them a little while ago, actually.
Yeah, and it is, you know, in this day and age, what we're finding is that monitoring is really the second half of what you have to do.
You can't just sit there and say, oh, I secured it.
Right.
That would be a very foolish attitude.
Right.
I was talking to somebody who worked at Sony Pictures Entertainment, who shall remain nameless, yesterday. And he said they had the security completely upside down.
I know who.
They wouldn't let you bring in a laptop. You know, you needed to do something. They wouldn't let you bring in a laptop because, oh, no, you can't put that on our network. But then they had absolutely no protection against spear phishing and what eventually happened. Had they had a canary, they would have at least known there was an intruder. That the intruder was in the Sony network for, what was it, 9 months?
Yeah, and remember that this is also where I famously said I couldn't create security for Sony. No one could.
No one could.
I mean, it's just too big and sprawling. Right. It would require that nobody ever click on an email attachment, and that's just not practical.
Yep.
Speaking of email, okay, so we know about HTTP HTTPS, Hypertext Transport Protocol, Strict Transport Security. The idea with that is that websites are able to essentially publish to anyone who connects to them. They're able to publish the fact that they only want to be connected to securely. So in the header of the response header to a query, so a client makes a query, or, you know, a user's browser makes a query to a website, and maybe they make it over HTTP, and then the website redirects them to HTTPS, the equivalent, or whatever. So for example, you may be able to get to that site over either HTTP or HTTPS. But in either event, in the response headers, the metadata that's not part of what you normally see, but things like, you know, the expiration date and cookies that may be assigned with that to that session, one of the things there says is this STS, the Strict Transport Security header, which gives a lifetime in the future the number of minutes that the site is willing to commit to always offering secure connections. So the idea is the browser will cache that. It'll store that if it supports strict transport security, and they all do now. It'll store that with a date stamp. It'll like look at today at now, the timestamp of now, and it'll add that many minutes that has been indicated to now and set a time to an expiration date in the future for when this expires if it isn't renewed anytime again. And of course, normally every visit will bump that timestamp forward that far again into the future. So what this does is this gives the web browser itself permission to upgrade any link to that domain from HTTP and connecting to port 80 to HTTPS and connecting to port 443, which is the well-known port for a secure HTTP connection. And this all works. Now, this still has the what's known as the first contact problem. And in fact, there's an acronym, TOFU, that we've talked about in the past, T-O-F-U, which is trust on first use. Because what that sort of reminds us is, well, we only get the knowledge of strict transport security after first contacting the website. We don't have it a priori ahead of time in any means. Now, there has been action taken there too. We'll remember that Google was leading this, and they offered any domains that wished it to register with them for inclusion in Chrome as a domain that will always be secure. GRC is proud to be enumerated among those, like early on, and it is still there. And so that solves the first contact problem if you basically build into the browser the permission for this domain, then you solve that trust on first use problem. The idea being that if the browser had never contacted an STS site and there was a man in the middle downgrading HTTPS to HTTP, and for example, also because of their man in the middle position, stripping the response header saying use strict transport security, then the browser would never have the opportunity to know the site offered it, and so wouldn't be able to take advantage of it, and could then run an exploit. But it just takes one trustworthy, one first contact to initialize the cache of that knowledge. So we have all that. We don't have security, useful security, today for email unless it's layered on top, like PGP, where the underlying transport mechanism is just known to be useless for security. So if you really care about a message being secure, you'll do something on top of it. Even if you weren't using PGP, you would, you know, write the message in some doc and then zip it with a good password and then attach it to an unsecure piece of email and to send it to somebody who knew the matching, you know, who knew the password, who would then receive it, unzip it, and view the doc. So, but the problem is that email has been really resistant, probably because it's a multi-component system where with the web browser, we just have a server and a client, like a one-to-one relationship. There is the email ecosystem has MTAs, as they call them, message transport agents, and MTUs are the user side, the initiate email and absorb mail. And the other problem is it's not just a one-to-one. I have my user agent and I place email on my SMTP server, my MTA, and then it has the freedom to connect to another one and another one and another one, and then finally a destination one. There have been historically crazy complex email systems that do use a multi-hop store and forward, because in fact the architecture, the original architecture, allows that. And in fact, one of the things that we've talked about in way years past was looking at your email headers, and you can see, like, you view from the first header backwards the path that the email took from one server to the next, because each of the hops, the server adds a few lines of information. That's done in order to prevent the possibility of loops, where due to the fact that you've got essentially email routing, it's possible to have a routing loop, which would cause email to go around in the circle forever if you didn't have some way of a server receiving a piece of email and checking the headers and saying, wait a minute, I already sent this, because it would see itself in its own headers that it had put on when it sent the mail out, and that would tell it, okay, we got a problem. This is not getting to its destination. So as a consequence of the fact that it is a more complex system, and that it's got deep history, it just hasn't been easy to upgrade this. Now, we've talked about one of the solutions, which is known as opportunistic TLS, and that is the server that is accepting a connection can give a list of capabilities and does give a list of capabilities in response to the hello message, which is the opening message in a dialogue that two servers, two SMTP servers have between each other as they're initiating their handshake. In the hello message, the connection accepting server lists its capabilities, and among them would be the statement start TLS, which is saying that it knows how to accept the start TLS command from the connection initiating server, which would allow them to bring up a private TLS link, a point-to-point link, which would then mean that the email that they would transit would not be in plain text, which it otherwise is. And this is a problem because by default, email, even in this day and age, is unencrypted between endpoints. Now, the problem with start TLS is that it is privacy protection only against a passive observer. That is, only somebody who can only monitor the network is going to be stumped by seeing start TLS happen. They're going to say, "Oh darn! Look, they both support start TLS, and I just saw the command go by, and now there's a TLS negotiation, and now it just looks like random pseudo random noise, and I can't see what the messaging is." The problem is a man in the middle, somebody active, an active attacker, simply drops the start TLS declaration from the list of supported features that the answering SMTP server offers, and then the accepting server won't attempt to bring up a TLS connection because it believes that the one it's connecting to doesn't know how to handle it. So it's trivially overridden. It's trivially susceptible to a man-in-the-middle attack. So what a group of people decided to do, and this is Google, Yahoo, Comcast, Microsoft, and 1&1 Mail and Media Development and Technology, that the German email provider, that group of five people, Google, Yahoo, Comcast, Microsoft, and 1&1, they've got a proposal. And I was all excited thinking, hey, okay, cool. That sounds like a good idea until I read it. Oh, goodness. So they're trying to do what for SMTP, what we have done for HTTP. Unfortunately, due to the details of the way SMTP works, it's not as simple as the server sending a header to say that I support security. Because it's trivially easy to intercept that, and we sort of already have that with start TLS. The server is saying, yeah, I support start TLS, and you simply strip that out, and now you're not going to have any security. So essentially, they've gone to great lengths to engineer a system that still has that problem, such that they fully acknowledge that they have the TOFU, the trust on first use problem. They have a system that allows the receiving server to cache the knowledge that the server it connected to supported security. So they are, once again, they're basically using the same model as HTTP STS is using, where you have to get the message through once and then they're going to cache it. But they use an out-of-band signaling. That is, they don't use the SMTP protocol in the same way that HTTP does use the existing HTTP protocol, which is one of the things that made this so simple. Instead, they go through all kinds of jumping through hoops. They want to create a specially named and well-known named subdomain in DNS off of the DNS domain name of the emails of the email domain. So, and that's called underscore SMTP underscore STS. Then it would be like dot, and for example, grc.com. So that subdomain would contain text records to describe the type of SMTP STS that this email server supports, and things like expiration time. But the problem is they recognize that DNS is not secure. And so all throughout this document, they're saying, well, really, we should have DNSSEC, but we don't. So here's what we're going to do. And so, for example, among the things that they do is that the records in this insecurely delivered DNS record can point to a well-known directory in an HTTPS server where it's possible to find the identical records that the DNS subdomain is delivering. I mean, this is just unbelievably horrific. And then, and the reason they do this is they want to take advantage of the PKI, the existing public key infrastructure, which does exist for the web, but doesn't exist for SMTP. So they use DNS to point to, and they call it Web PKI is the name in the field that they're using. And that contains an HTTPS URL referring to the same domain and a directory, which is dot SMTP underscore STS, then slash, and then SMTP hyphen STS, and then a document name. And that contains records which have to be exactly the same as what DNS is publishing. The further I dug into this, the more I couldn't believe what, like, the hoops that they were jumping through in order to try to get something that still has the trust on first use problem, and where throughout the document they're saying, but this would really be better if we just had DNSSEC. And so I'll just remind everyone that DNSSEC, when it finally happens, and it's coming along very slowly, what it will allow is absolutely secure publishing of anything we want to publish. So, for example, right now, we have a public key hierarchy where we trust certificate authorities and they sign our web server certificates, and that's the way we trust them. But but if we had DNSSEC, that is, if we absolutely could cryptographically rely on what a DNS response has, then a domain could publish its own certificate, and a client could look up the certificate in the domain, because and what we don't have today is that is the absolute ability to securely sign what the DNS provides. If we had that, then the certificate could be known to be true, and it could then use that to compare it to the certificate coming from a web server, and there'd be no need for a third party for domain verification. Again, there in the same way that we still have a use for extended validation verification, where we're asserting much more than just a certificate for a domain, we still need a third party. So there's still a use for third party certificate authorities. But the point is, and we've talked about DNSSEC through the years, it would be wonderful to have this, because another thing it would do is it could provide a simple statement that this email server accepts secure connections. End of story. And so SMTP servers could that are using DNS to look up the MX record, the mail exchange record, and sometimes the mail exchange server name or IP, could also pull some future defined record, and this crazy SMTP STS RFC even talks about, oh yeah, you know, be nice to have a new RR, a resource record in DNS that could be securely delivered over DNSSEC, and it would just say, yeah, this domain supports security. Well, let's just do that, because the problem is this kludge from hell. If this ever got traction, it just mucks up everything to an incredible degree in order to try to get security, which remains weak even if we did all of this. And it just strews its junk all over the place. So, end of rant.
All right.
I was thinking this thing sounds wonderful until I read it. And then it's like, oh, please don't let this happen. Please, please, please. Because, as I said, the subtitle of this podcast is Horrible Internet Kludges Never Die. And this is one for the record books in terms of just being a horrific kludge. Yikes. We just need DNSSEC. If this energy could have been put in furtherance of DNSSEC, it would have been far better invested.
Yeah.
Because if we get that, we get everything else. I mean, I can't even imagine the things we're going to be able to do after we get good DNS security.
Right on. Someday. Well, Steve, what fun it has been. I think we're done.
Next week,
right?
Q&A. Yep, yeah, we're done.
Yeah, we have strewn the net internet with our words.
If this can help this to keep this from happening, then it was time well spent. Oh, Lord!
Steve's website is
unbelievable.
Well, you know, they're trying. Yeah. Steve's website is grc.com. That's the place where you can find SpinRite, the world's best hard drive recovery and maintenance utility, and also all of his other fine stuff, like, I don't know, shoot the messenger, shields up, decombobulator, perfect paper passwords, never 10. Is there an updater in that, or do you have to just download a new version if you want to?
No, just it's 83K. The updater would have expanded it up. Yeah. I'm not even sure what I'm going to do with the Squirrel client, because you don't have to install it, but people want to install it.
Right.
And
run it.
Yeah. Except that, you know, browsers go put things in the download directory.
Right.
And then, so I think it should install itself. That is, you and I'll talk to all.
You can do that. When you run it, you move yourself to the applications folder, and
right.
That's it. Yeah.
Right. Right.
A lot of apps, not a lot, but some apps I think do that, and I think that's the right way to do it.
That'll add.
That's not an installer. That's a mover.
It's a mover.
It'll add one line. Am I in the programs and features or whatever it is? And I am in percent app docs percent. Well, then move me there.
Yeah.
Yeah. What else? The show's there.
Unless I'm on a removable drive, it's aware of that already. And so, because you want to be able to carry it around,
right,
and be able to run it from the drive.
That's
so
the way to do it.
About that.
Yeah. Oh, let them run it from download. Who cares?
Except that some people purge their download folder from time to time.
Well, but that's fine. You only run it once.
I haven't figured out what I'm going to do.
I mean, Squirrel, you don't have to run it again, right?
I think I may have an announcement next week. Yeah, I finished a chunk of work yesterday, and I've got a great week ahead of me. So, yeah.
Good. Yay.
Getting close.
Check up on Squirrel's progress at the website, grc.com. You can also find the podcast itself, including transcriptions, at grc.com. Steve's healthy sleep formula is there. Somebody sent me an email. I can't find Never 10. It's on the website. It's in projects, right? Or Google Never 10 works really good. Yeah.
Yeah. Google, you know, is the internet, you know.
Yeah.
So it says my realtor friend Judy. I just put it in the
She's
Google.
Not far
I just asked.
Wrong.
I just asked the Google.
How do you get to Yahoo Google? Oh, this way. Over here. if you want audio or video of the show, you can also get it from us, twit.tv/SN. We put it on YouTube. We put it on the internet as a podcast. That means you can use your podcast client to download it. All you have to do is get the podcast client and search for Security Now. You'll find audio and video versions. Of course, there's Twit apps, too, on every platform. That's another way to do it. We will be back here next Tuesday, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC for yet another edition. I guess a Q&A, barring
Q&A time.
Barring problems in security. So get your questions to Steve at SGGRC on the Twitter or grc.com/feedback.
Yep.
We'll pick 10 and do those next week. Thanks,
Steve. My friend. Thanks.
Bye. Security.